This is the MedicCast, January 31st, 2011.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the MedicCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this week's show. We have a bunch of good stuff coming up, including going back to basics, a look at initial assessment and review. So for all you students out there, this will be helpful. And of course, I think it's always important for us to review the basics, to think about some of these things that we haven't maybe, if you've been a provider for a long time, thought about for an extended period of time. Maybe there are segments of the initial assessment that you've been kind of glossing over. So we'll be talking about that later on in the show after this week's news segment. In the meantime, I do want to remind you that everything we talk about this week, including links to the news items and links to additional resources on the weekly tip or interview segment, are all available over at the website for the MedicCast, medicast.com/blog, and you'll find links for the show notes right there at the top of the page, so definitely follow up on that. And of course, don't forget to send me emails and comments via the email or voicemail line, and that's podmedic@mac.com or call in on the voicemail line 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. Let's jump on in and check out with our listener email right now, and we'll get onto that right now. So we've been getting a lot of listener email in. I try to respond to every single email that comes in, and I share some of them with you here on the show. Got an email in from a longtime listener and supporter of the show, Justin. Justin has kicked off his own podcast, and I think that's exciting. I really enjoy seeing all of the new EMS podcasts that are springing to life out there, and I hope that they continue to put the effort out and put out great programming. You can check out Justin's new podcast, EMS Pulse. And it's really exciting to see what he's putting out there. You can find his show over at the ProMed Network, and that's at promednetwork.com, and you can find all of the EMS programming over there. Just type EMS or paramedic or EMT into the search field, and they'll come up. And you can find this show and all the other great shows that are available over there. But it's great to have Justin sharing his thoughts in this podcast. And you know, I keep telling people, there are always opportunities and there's always room for someone else's voice in this space or in the blogging space. I think that it's important that we share what we have to say with each other. And whether that's via a video program like I do here on the MedicCast, of course there's an audio version as well, or just an audio podcast or a YouTube series of videos, a blog, whatever the case may be, it's really important that we continue to communicate and use these social media tools to reach out to each other and share our opinions. And it's great to hear that Justin's doing just that. So Justin, welcome to the podcasting community. And you know, it's going to take work. A lot of people start a podcast, don't realize how much effort it takes to put one together. But I hope you will continue to put forth your shows and work through finding exactly how your voice is developing and different things. You know, if you listen to the first episode of the MedicCast, it's pretty rough. And Justin, your show sounds great right now to get started with. But, you know, it's going to change and grow and shape itself over time. And I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, how that continues to develop and work out. And it's just great to have you here as part of the network and part of things going on. Again, you can find the EMS Pulse podcast as well as the brand new EMS Research podcast, and of course all the other great EMS and other medical programming over at the ProMed Network, and you can find that at promednetwork.com. We also have got an email in from listener Greg, who shared some before and after photos from some recent severe flooding that they had down in the Brisbane area in Australia. We have a lot of listeners, a lot of members of the MedicCast community down there in Australia, and of course they are working through, you know, when they have these types of situations happen, just as they happen up here, natural disasters, you know, the emergency services and response community is right at the forefront and in the midst of all of that chaos. And so I thought you might like to see some of the links that he shared. I actually posted the link that Greg shared over at the Medicast Facebook fan page. So if you aren't already a fan over there, you can head over to facebook.com/Medicast. And when you listen to this, if you listen soon after it's published, you'd probably have to scroll down a few posts, but it'll be there, a link to the before and after photos, some interesting aerial photographs of what the area looked like before the flooding and then after the flooding. Just really, really devastating. And of course, our thoughts and prayers go out to everybody that was affected by that flooding, I guess, a week or so ago. And again, thank you, Greg, for sharing this link and giving us an opportunity. You know, when you look at this, consider how your area might be affected by a similar natural disaster or another type of natural disaster and how you would be prepared to respond to that. And you can get an idea of why it's important for us to share these types of things. Finally, got an email from a good friend of mine over at Physiocontrol, Eric Denny, and he's checking in about some of the things that are going on with our podcast booth at EMS Today. And I'm really excited, of course, for a lot of you that maybe came and caught up with us at our other conference appearances in the past. EMS Today is coming up the first week of March, I think March 1st through 5th in Baltimore, Maryland. And we're going to be producing podcasts with the ProMed Network live continuously during the exhibit hall open hours. So starting Thursday evening, all day Friday and Saturday until about 2, we will be producing shows live from the podcast booth there at EMS Today. And I want to encourage you, if you're in the area, if you haven't been to one of these shows before, make an effort to come down. If you go to the conferences, the continuing education is excellent. If you just want to get an exhibit hall pass and come in and check out all the cool stuff, I mean, just you get to see all the new gadgets, you get to get hands-on with some new equipment, some things you've maybe always wanted to try, don't have in your service, and want to give it a shot and a tryout, you can do that at these places. New ambulance, I mean, t-shirts, you name it, it's there. And of course, also podcasts. And so I urge you to come by the podcast booth and check in with us, hang out, listen to the shows. We'll have seating there. It's not going to interrupt anybody. That's what the chairs are there for. Just come in and sit down, bring a buddy with you, get a bite to eat, sit down and have your lunch while you're sitting there listening to a show. Stick around and meet your favorite podcasters after they get done recording each episode. And just really, it'd be great to meet all the listeners. I so look forward to these opportunities and get to meet listeners and shake their hands. And of course, there'll be tweet ups and other social media type of events. So if you're following on Twitter and Facebook, you'll get to know where we're going to be hanging out in the evenings too. And we welcome everybody to come by and hang out with us, both in the podcast booth and afterwards, after hours in Baltimore. So again, coming down to EMS Today, March 1st through 5th, and I think the exhibit hall opens on the 3rd in the evening. And again, just come on down, check out all the great stuff, and enjoy a podcast and meet your favorite podcasters while you're down there. And Eric, thanks for asking about that. Of course, anybody out there that's interested in sponsorship opportunities, they are offering sponsorship opportunities. You have to go through GEMS, through EMS Today's folks to get that lined up. But we welcome anybody that might have a company and want to share some information about their products. We're going to make it worth your while. So if you want to sponsor one of our episodes down there, you can do that. And I'll be there. Chris Montero with the EMS Garage and EMS Leadership Podcast. I think Greg Fries is going to be there with an EMS Educast. Rick Rosati coming in to do a Mitigation Journal, one of his first appearances at this type of conference, and we're really excited to have him there. Of course, Natalie Quibido, the Ms. Paramedic herself, and others from the GenMed show will be coming in, and we'll be doing a GenMed show. Plus, we're going to be bringing in other podcasters and special guests, and I'm really looking forward to having the opportunity to see all the cool stuff down there and take an opportunity to have all of those great individuals together to pull together for some great and enlightening panel discussions. So we're looking forward to that. And Eric, thanks for checking in. And I hope to see all of you there down in Baltimore beginning of March. Time now for a look at this week's news, EMS and healthcare news. And I'm going to kick off with a story I picked up out of the UK about allegedly ambulance workers refusing to transport a patient who later died. And you know, if you've been listening to me for any length of time, I'm not going to go down the path of they're wrong, they've screwed up, their lives are forfeit, whatever. No, I'm not going to say that because I don't know what's happened. And I know there's always another side to these stories. And I just can't understand that. I don't believe that any EMS provider just randomly chose not to take a patient to the hospital. So I'm sure there is a lot more to this story. But we have other lessons we can learn from stories like this, and that's what I'd like to comment on. First off, this is about a woman who was apparently a sickle cell patient. She was in crisis, apparently, and the ambulance service was called to come and pick her up. According to the landlady, she says they didn't take her to the hospital because she had soiled herself. Heck, if that was a criteria for not riding in the ambulance, I don't know how many patients I would have taken to the hospital over the years. Based on that, I wouldn't have taken many. So if that were the only criteria, that wouldn't be it. And it just doesn't make sense to me. So I suspect there's more to this story than meets the eye. But the lesson we can learn is this. How this shakes out for these EMS professionals is going to depend on their documentation. If they have a good reason for not transporting this patient, like a valid patient refusal, as there may be, that's certainly all right. But there needs to be documentation of exactly how you arrived at that decision and that you gave the patient an opportunity to make an informed and non-coerced decision to stay home. And that is done through appropriate documentation. I always tell people, if you're going to do a patient refusal, don't do it because it's going to save you paperwork, because I'm going to expect you to do more documentation for a patient refusal than you would for another patient. Of course, the reason I say that is because in most e-patient reports, these electronic patient reporting software, if you have a patient refusal, it misses and skips a whole bunch of screens that you might otherwise have filled out for a patient that you transport, assessment screens and interventions and things like that. Well, heck, you know what? I expect you to have done some sort of an assessment on this patient, even if it's a visual inspection, if they don't want you to actually lay hands on them. I want you to document exactly what you told the patient and how you tried to convince them to go to the hospital if you thought they needed to go and they chose not to. Or if there really didn't seem to be anything going on, I want to know why your findings pointed that way. And so I always tell people, if you're doing a refusal, it's not to save anybody time, because I expect your documentation to be even more thorough than you might be with a patient you transport to the hospital. And I hope that that points out to you the need to really, documentation is going to be the only thing that covers your tail when you end up with a problem. When a patient says that one thing happened and you say another thing happened, the only thing that's going to help back you up is, did you write about a certain incident that might have occurred during a transport in your report? You really need to really be thorough when you document patient things and what goes on in the back of an ambulance. So I can't say enough about this. I think this is a great example of why documentation is going to be so important to each and every one of you. And it's not a question of if you'll ever have to come across a situation like this. If you're in this business long enough, you're going to come across a situation where your decisions are going to be questioned. And, you know, you may have made a mistake in some way, and that happens in patient treatment through no malice on your part. But appropriate documentation will certainly be able to back up your thought process and make it perhaps a decision that was medically wrong but situationally appropriate, and can be an educational opportunity for you to learn something new about applying your protocols to specific patients. And the only way that you're going to be in a position to keep your job in those types of situations is to make sure you document what happened fully. So enough said about that. I just think it's important when we see things like this to talk about this type of issue. Now, coming up, we have a nice article on fire departments and EMS services that have dual response capabilities. So often we will have ambulance services that are covering a broad area, and local fire departments will be dispatched as first response units where they have EMTs or paramedics on board. In some places, because of turf wars or because of jurisdictional concerns, the providers on the fire units may not have the same capabilities that are commensurate with their training level. And this has been an issue in Naples, Florida, where the local fire department has finally gotten approval to allow their paramedics on their fire trucks to act as full ALS providers and have their own medical director and protocols and be able to do what they can to stabilize patients prior to the arrival of the ambulance service that will transport that patient. And they will have the ability, if necessary, to ride along during the transport and assist the transporting paramedic along the way if the patient requires additional support and is critical enough. I think this is important because we need to think about how we operate between jurisdictions, and especially areas that are going to have two different zones where two different medical directors, two different sets of protocols come across each other or overlap, as is going to happen in this case. We need to make sure we understand how the other services near us are operating, and we need to treat them with respect. So often, I get into these situations where I hear paramedics bad-mouthing another group of paramedics because their medical director is more conservative than the other ones. You know, just because one group of paramedics can administer thrombolytics and another group of paramedics, you know, is barely allowed to use a dual-lumen airway, doesn't mean that they aren't medical professionals, doesn't mean that they haven't been at least trained to the minimum level you've been trained to do. And certainly, they deserve your respect because, let's face it, they're going to be doing more for their patients with less than you are. And there's no reason for you to be bad-mouthing anybody else out there simply because their protocols maybe allow different actions under different circumstances or have a different skill set or medication kit. And so I just point out to you that we really need to be respectful of each other. And I have a lot more respect for that paramedic with a smaller, tighter set of protocols who has to treat the same types of patients I treat with a broader set of protocols because they've got to make do with less and have and take care of those patients. And their knowledge base certainly allows them to know that there are other things they could be doing for them, but they have to figure out ways to get around that and treat their patients as best they can within the scope of practice that they have available to them. And I, like I said, I have a lot more respect for somebody who's able to make do with less than for somebody that has every bell and whistle and every skill at their command and you know, still finds time to put down somebody else's service. So that's how I feel about that. And I think it's important for us to understand that, you know, how these little stupid turf wars get started is just like that, because people say don't want to have respect for the providers across the nearby border. And it's not a good way to operate, because when a major incident happens, you're going to want them to come help you, and they're going to want you to come help them. And you guys better get along, because the only people that are going to get hurt in the end are the patients. Finally, just an interesting story that came up this week after we'd been covering stroke care for the last 2 weeks and kind of doing a mini stroke series here, talking about stroke awareness, and also last week looking at a little more in-depth about what happens with these patients after we drop them off, talking about the effects of stress hyperglycemia on stroke patients. And so interestingly enough, I came up with a story in the news this week about a recent study looking at the mortality rates for people that are transported to stroke centers when compared to those who aren't transported to dedicated stroke centers when they have a stroke. And the study is showing that there is a modest decrease in the mortality rate for patients when taken to a stroke center. The dedicated stroke centers are those centers that have had some met the criteria to have an integrated approach towards caring for stroke patients. And by integrated approach, I mean they have to have community outreach for stroke education so people recognize strokes better. They have to be working closely with their EMS services so that they are supporting the EMS service and allowing them to get the information they need, and also to be able to listen to that EMS service when they call in and say, hey, it's a stroke, I'm on my way, to use that as the initial point where they activate their stroke team. In the hospital, they have a multidisciplinary stroke team of physicians, nurses, radiologists, imaging specialists, so that the CT scanner is ready to go. so that this patient is brought in, rapidly assessed, rapidly identified the type of stroke they're having, ischemic or hemorrhagic, and then what are the appropriate treatment, such as thrombolytics for the ischemic strokes, brought on board. And it's nice to see that the stroke centers are showing some modest decreases in mortality rates. Now, the study does point out that, while it's a modest decrease, when you look at it for real numbers, it's actually you're 20% more likely to have a better outcome in your stroke when you go to a stroke center than you are if you go to a non-stroke center. And I think those numbers are only going to improve as the stroke centers continue to tighten up their procedures and policies, as they continue to review how they are approaching their patient care as a stroke center, and trying again to reduce that door to thrombolytic time, just like we do with cardiac patients. What is the door to balloon time? And that cath lab identifies their success rate based on that number. And stroke centers are no different. What is the door to thrombolytic time for ischemic strokes? Because those are the patients that are going to have a significant effect and on their recovery, on their level of disability after the stroke, and everything else. So I urge you to follow up on the links of these news items over in the show notes at medicast.com/blog, and click that show notes link at the top of the page, find this episode, and read these articles for yourself, and think about some of the things I've talked about. And again, I'd urge you to share this stroke study with people in your community and use it as a springboard to talk about your local designated stroke center, or perhaps maybe talk to your medical director about getting one of the local hospitals or your only local hospital to become a designated stroke center for your community. It's something that I think is attainable even by smaller medical facilities. Time now for this week's tip of the week, and I will be talking about initial assessment. Now, wait a minute. I know a lot of you out there are existing providers and are turning off your podcasts right now. Your iPod, your MP3 players, you're turning off and switching to another site. Do not do that, okay? I think one of the things that we miss the most as experienced providers is the opportunity to do brief reviews of things like initial assessment. What are some of the little things that you're missing when you get into that initial stage of assessing a patient? Some of these things become automatic, but in that automaticity, sometimes we end up dropping some of the finer points by the wayside. So it never hurts any of us to review. And heck, it's not going to be that long. So take a listen, and maybe you'll have an opportunity to share this with a new student, perhaps a new EMT or paramedic, somebody you're precepting. And again, this is an opportunity for, of course, the students to use as for study purposes as well. And again, there'll be additional resources in the show notes to give you more to follow up on here. I'm combining a scene survey and initial assessment kind of together. I think they happen both almost simultaneously in some regards. There's aspects of both of these that overlap. And so I always like to think of them together, because there are pieces of them that are going to happen interlaced in some ways. Some things you're going to do that are going to be part of the scene survey process that are going to happen after you do portions of the initial assessment. So let's talk a little bit about that. We're going to review some things here. We're going to talk about the purpose of these initial steps. Really, why is it so important? Why do we have to focus on this? Why are EMS instructors driving EMT students and paramedic students nuts with scene survey stuff and initial assessment things? Well, there's a reason for it, and we'll talk about that. We're going to talk about these as they fit into the whole picture, the big picture of the whole patient transport care assessment spectrum. And we'll talk about how these fit into that spectrum. And you know, this is going to be part of an ongoing series, so we'll eventually cover all parts of those pieces. But this is the beginning of it, and we want to see how it fits. We'll talk about the steps, specific steps of the scene survey, and then the specific steps of the initial assessment. And finally, we're going to talk about some study tips. How, if you're a student, or if you're somebody who's reviewing, or has to, even as an instructor, what are some of the best ways to study these types of skills and memory tools. So we're going to talk a little bit about the different ways you can study these things and hopefully find something that matches your learning style, because everyone learns differently. And so you're going to find that some people can memorize things and they can play them back and do them right every time. Other people are good at book learning and the skills give them difficulties. Some people can do stuff hands-on once after they've seen it done, but have trouble with memorizing definitions. So there are ways to study that will enable you to learn the way that is most appropriate for you. And we'll talk about that in the student study tips section. So what is the purpose of these initial steps in the assessment process? Why is it so important? Well, initial assessment sets the stage for the entire rest of the patient experience. And I mean that from your standpoint as well as the patient's standpoint. There are so many things that are going to set up how the call goes. And often when there are problems in an assessment or problems with how a patient outcome occurred, or perhaps something that happened as a result of the call, perhaps an attack on the providers, we can trace back to some portions of these initial steps where there may have been warning signs, where there may have been a misstep or an assessment that went down a wrong pathway and the diagnosis was off track. So the initial assessment is really important for getting the rest of the patient assessment correct. Does this mean that if you get the initial assessment wrong, everything else is wrong? No, because as we'll talk about later, as it fits into the whole picture, the initial assessment, and indeed I think the scene survey, are ongoing portions of every other step. There are always opportunities for you to review and step back and start from the beginning again. And in fact, with some aspects of scene survey, you should be keeping that awareness going constantly while on scene and alone with a patient in the back of the ambulance. These initial steps build patient rapport. I so often hear from young students and new providers, how do I act the medical professional for an elderly patient when all they see is a teenager or a young adult? And how do I impact upon them the importance of listening to what I have to say? How you handle yourself professionally from the very moment you appear in their field of vision is going to have a lot to do with how they take your advice and listen to what you have to say and follow your direction for the rest of the whole call. So a lot of what you do here professionally will stand you in good stead and build that initial impression from the patient and build rapport. You control the scene and the bystanders also by regard of some of the steps of your scene survey, by your professionalism with your initial assessment and initial interaction with the patient and their family members. You exert control over the scene. You take control of an out-of-control situation, as so often these things are. Even in the case of somebody with chest pains, the family and that patient have called you because they can't handle it. Whatever the problem is, it is out of their hands. It's not something they can just put a Band-Aid on and take an aspirin and go to bed. This is something that is out of their control. By your arrival and taking control, you gather control and are in charge of the scene and of the bystanders. And that can protect you, very importantly, by just being in command and being able to direct things. And in larger situations can stand you in good stead. Of course, it protects your crew. These initial steps are going to be part of these initial steps, the scene safety aspects of it and the body substance isolation, that scene safety BSI, are part of the things that protect your crew, you and your crew, from things that might occur to you, whether it's an attack, whether it's bodily fluids, taking appropriate protective action. All of that starts with what goes on in this initial steps. And it allocates resources. As we become busier and busier and busier, good use of initial assessment and scene control is going to be one of the things that's going to help allocate resources appropriately for systems. And this, as a management tool, this is very important. As we begin to see more and more systems start to have scene-based assessment, and perhaps patients don't always get transported anymore. Perhaps a patient or an EMT or paramedic arrives at the scene in a chase vehicle, in a car or an SUV, and they will be making an assessment of a patient that perhaps can be get a taxi or be driven to an urgent care center. They don't need an ambulance. Allocation of resources is an important part of this. And of course, in those situations where you need additional resources, rescue or mass casualty incidents where you need additional transport units, all of that comes into play here. Let's see how this all fits in as part of the whole assessment, the scene size up and the initial assessment. You start off with your dispatch information. You know, you get dispatched to that call and you're going to get a set of information, a little picture of what we think we're going to see. Now, you can say, hey, dispatchers don't always get it right. It's not because the dispatchers didn't get it right. The person on the other end of the phone didn't give them the correct information. I've never met a dispatcher yet that hasn't been very, very conscientious about making sure I had all the information they had. So I think we need to, sometimes there's an adversarial relationship when I talk to some people about dispatchers as if they're doing something on purpose to give us bad information. That's not the case at all. They're giving us what they have, and patients aren't always honest with them, or patients aren't always thinking straight when they talk on 911 calls. So dispatch info has to be taken with a grain of salt, but at least it gives you an idea. Are we looking at a medical or a trauma call? Do we expect violence at the scene because it's an assault? All of that information is important. We then have the scene survey and the initial assessment that happens as you arrive at the scene and as you begin to take control of the scene and you first see your patient. You're then, after you had that initial setup and you've gotten a look at your patient and taking care of any major problems, you're going to have that focused history, that physical exam that may occur based on what you've found, based on the first things that have happened, the dispatch info, the scene survey, the initial assessment. You're now getting that history of what happened, and you're going to be applying a physical exam appropriate to what's going on. You then have a detailed physical exam looking at specific things. So you've done a head-to-toe at this point, or you've gotten an idea of what's going on. Now it's a detailed physical exam. You're going to go head-to-toe, and you're going to focus in on exactly what the problem is. So you've looked at the whole person. Maybe they're conscious and alert, and they've told you, hey, I broke my arm. Now you're going to be focusing on the actual arm. Where is the problem? What can we do? Ongoing assessment happens next, and you know, this is one of those things I think it's important for us to remember that ongoing assessment is really what's going to be happening kind of in the background all the way along. At every step of the way, you need to be prepared to take a step backward in the process and start from scratch. You need to always be conscious of scene surroundings and what's going on around you. If a set of bystanders becomes hostile for some reason, you need to be aware of that because there's a safety issue there, and maybe it's time to bug out. Even if you're not ready to really load and go with this patient, it may be the best option. If you start seeing things that don't match up with your initial diagnosis based on your focused history and your first physical exam, there may be an opportunity to say, hey, wait a minute, let's step back here. Do your initial assessment again. Is there something going wrong with this patient that I missed in that initial assessment? And then start down the path again, and maybe you're going to go in a different direction. So ongoing assessment really talks about the whole process. It is a specific segment of itself, and yes, there are things you do there, but I want you to think about every step of this process as really a place where you can repeat steps as needed for specific patients, because no one is the perfect patient. There is no such thing. Everybody's different. Every situation is going to be different. Every chest pain is different from the next chest pain. So it's important to know. And then that communication with online medical control, you call into the hospital, whatever the case may be, your handoff at the hospital, and then documentation, all part of the assessment process as you wrap up what you did and talk about it in your documentation so that you can repeat back what happened if you need to and defend anything that you may have done in the way of interventions. Let's talk about the specific steps now of the scene survey. You've gotten that dispatch info, you're reviewing your stuff, and you know kind of what you're going to be seeing. You have an expectation. Obviously, as we said earlier, a grain of salt might need to be taken with this, but usually, you know, they get the basics right, and because the information they've received is what's been passed on to you, we have a chest pain call, we have a motor vehicle accident, we have an assault, we have a syncopal episode. All of these things, you know, are based upon our dispatch information, and it gives us an idea of, hey, what are we going to grab out of the ambulance as we go in the door? Next, scene safety, BSI. Hey, I say it here on the show every week. And some people say to me, hey, what does scene safety, BSI mean? I mean, I get scene safety, but what's BSI? BSI is body substance isolation. It's that simple. It's the universal precautions, if you will. People that are not in the U.S., or at least in my part of the U.S., may not understand this, but this is what you say as part of your scene survey and initial assessment to tell the preceptor that, hey, I'm not wearing gloves because we just don't want to burn through gloves at every station here, but I'm thinking about scene safety and universal precautions. I'm looking around for the guy with the gun, and I'm thinking about how to get out of here and watching my exits, and I'm going to be wearing the appropriate gear for this situation, whether it's eye protection, gloves, gown, mask, headgear, whatever the case may be. You're going to be wearing the appropriate protective equipment. Next, we're going to be thinking about mechanism or nature of the injury or illness. And so that, you know, if it's a trauma call, mechanism of injury is important. Nature of illness is going to be for your medical calls. But it's important to just think about this in this stage. Okay, you've gotten your dispatch information. You think you have a chest pain call. When you get there, you find that the chest pain call is because the old man was up trying to take a limb out of the tree and fell down out of the tree. Is he having chest pain from a medical problem now, or is he having chest pain because he fell out of a tree and hurt his chest? He broke a couple of ribs. Obviously, that information becomes expanded and you start getting a sense of, hey, what really happened here? Are we having a medical situation or are we having a trauma situation? Number of patients. Never assume there's just one patient. In fact, I can't tell you, there's been a number of times when I've gone to the house of an injured elderly person and ended up having to get an ambulance for the spouse too, because they started having shortness of breath and chest pain because of the anxiety of the situation involving their spouse. So it's just something to keep in mind, that number of patients, and this is an indication of why we need to revisit these steps throughout the course of the call, because there may be situations where you have additional patients. And so, but initially, hey, how many patients do I have? If it's a motor vehicle accident, is it one or two vehicles? If it's two vehicles, you can expect that there's at least two people. If it's just one vehicle, how many people were in the vehicle? Do you need to search the surroundings if there's signs that there may have been an ejection? If you see a baby seat in the back of the vehicle or a toddler booster seat, was the child in the car, unbuckled themselves and wandered off with a head injury? These are things you need to be thinking about. Don't assume that just because you have the driver, and don't assume that there was no one else in the car until you've verified that there's no one else in the car. And that may require you to call in an engine company to come in with flashlights and walk through the surrounding field, because you suspect there may have been a kid in the car, until you can find out from next of kin or have the police track down, hey, is the child at daycare or did the mother already pick the child up? These are questions you can ask. Additional resource needs. And again, this is where you look at the number of patients. You look at those additional things you might need, such as the engine company to search the surroundings for a second patient, whether it's the police officers you need to control an unruly set of bystanders or protect you from a patient problem or family members. These additional resources, additional ambulances, and if you're a BLS unit, ALS resources that need to come in. In my county, we have ALS resources, but there are supervisory ALS resources that have RSI capability that are able to put patients under for intubation purposes. So if you think you need that, you've got to call them. And they listen to the radio, and sometimes they self-dispatch based on what they've heard going on in the background, but they are an additional resource to consider. And so there's all kinds of things. It may be, depending on your area, it may be something like calling state highways to come in and block off a lane of the road with one of those big arrow signs. there are, whatever the resources that are available may be unique to your community, but certainly this is where you consider that. And that's going to wrap part one of our segment on scene survey and initial assessment. Check in next week for part two of this segment, where we wrap up scene survey and get into initial assessment and how that fits into the whole picture. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the Medicast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show this week. Again, you'll find links in the show notes for all the news items and all of the additional resource links for this week's tip of the week, all available for you over at medicast.com/blog. You'll find a show notes link at the top of the page, the most recent episode always listed first under that link, and then you can go ahead and scroll down to find the episode you're looking for. You'll find links there, additional resources, links to the song of the week, whatever you need. All available there under the show notes link. If you'd like to get back in touch with me, of course, I love to hear from you. I try to respond to every email I get, and I'm looking forward to hearing from you when you check in with ideas, suggestions for future episodes, links for news items you found this week. All you can do by sending in your emails to podmedic@mac.com. And I look forward to hearing from you. Of course, you can call in on the voicemail line too. Call in on the voicemail line at 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. And I will get back to you right away. We will, of course, if you leave a message there, if you leave your email address at the end, I'll try to respond back to you. But often I just put those voicemails right here on the show, and you get to hear my response in an upcoming week live on the show. So when I get those, I play them for the other listeners. And again, if you want, put your email at the end of them, and I will be able to get back in touch with you if I have any further questions. And again, use the voicemail line. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter or Facebook if you'd like. Twitter.com/podmedic or Facebook.com/podmedic, and join the thousands of other fans already members over on the Medicast Facebook fan page. You can go ahead and become a fan over there. Head to Facebook.com/medicast, click the like button at the top of the page, and become a fan of the Medicast on Facebook. That's it. We're going to go ahead and close out this week's episode with some great PodSafe music. Let me go ahead and check my list here. We have a song here by Mercury in Summer called No, I Won't Let You Go, and I hope you enjoy it. If you like what you hear, you'll find a link in the show notes to the band's website, and I urge you to let them know you heard it here on the Medicast. That's it for me. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. I'll be back again next week with another episode here of the Medicast. In the meantime, I want to urge you to keep in mind, especially as part of your initial assessment stage, scene safety and BSI. You can say that you'll be back, but no words can fill the gap that you leave in my life when you're gone. Every picture that I have,
let you go, not today. No, I won't let you go, no way.